This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and happy Friday, everybody. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with the New England Patriots. They actually played football last night. Tom Brady was free and picked up where he left off last year, leading his team to a convincing victory over the Pittsburgh Steelers. But this week, just when you thought it was safe to root openly for the team, came another set of allegations about cheating by the Pats and a cover-up by the NFL. ESPN reported this week that the Patriots' Spygate scandal was much worse than previously believed. The team allegedly videotaped opposing team signals from 40 different games over 7 years, engaged in a pattern of spying, even theft against opposing teams. Also, allegations that NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell tried to cover it all up to avoid congressional scrutiny, only to come down especially hard on the Patriots for Deflategate and a kind of makeup call. Here's how the Boston Globe's Ben Volen summed it up for us this week.
They basically confirmed that Deflategate was owner-driven revenge. It felt like a witch hunt. It felt like the NFL went out of its way to try to finally capture and penalize the Patriots. Really, it's the buildup of almost 15 years of what the NFL believes is the Patriots skirting the rules.
The Patriots, of course, denied it all, and cheaters or not, they proved last night that the big, messy off-season controversy didn't affect their winning ways. Well, joining us now to talk about this and the rest of the week's news is op-ed contributor to the Boston Globe, Renee Graham. And Renee, great to see you here. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Anthony.
Yes, good to have you. Also with us is John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University. He's a senior news analyst for WBUR. John, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Always good to be here.
So let's start with whatever we're calling this, Spygate, Deflategate, Patriotgate, too much of everything gate. But as you heard, we spoke to Ben Volen earlier this week about these articles from ESPN and Sports Illustrated. And he said it looks like Deflategate was basically an NFL commissioner Roger Goodell's retribution for Spygate. John, what did we learn this week? What was the major takeaway for you?
Well, first, in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I'm a lifelong New York Giants fan, which is,
so am I.
I think, in and, of, its,
yes.
in and of itself, right. punishment enough. So no one should feel obliged to go to the Radio Boston website and abuse me even further. Anyway, there are two parallel universes at work here. One is Patriot Nation, which is all haters gonna hate. And then the other is everybody else who thinks the Patriots are the Bill and Hillary Clinton of the NFL. You know, bending the rules, telling the truth a little bit at a time. There's no intersection between the two narratives here that are going on. And I think that, you know, if I know one thing here, I know there's no bottom to this well. And it's never going to be over. It's never going to be resolved.
And what happened this week just sort of made those two bottomless wells even
more bottomless.
Even more bottomless.
And I think that everybody, Roger Goodell in particular, is doing more harm than good every time he opens his mouth because he's engaged in Deflategate, which is essentially he's trying to construct a narrative that covers his rear end, and it's not working at all. He's been exposed as somebody who is really unfamiliar with the truth.
So, Renee, what did you take away this week?
You know, if Roger Goodell wasn't such a clown, and I don't mean to insult clowns by calling him one, this would be so much easier.
Yeah.
You know, you could look at the Patriots and say they've gotten to the point where they don't care what they do to win, you know, but Roger Goodell keeps screwing it up. So if the idea is that Spygate was worse than initially thought, then why weren't the Patriots punished to the full extent at that point? You don't get to do a makeup pitch with Deflategate. Yeah. And it feels like that's what Roger Goodell did. So even if the Patriots are dirty in this, and frankly, I kind of think they are, it's almost irrelevant because Roger Goodell has had the most disastrous tenure leading the NFL.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's a counter argument that says the owners are really happy with Roger Goodell because they're the ones who drove this and they're the ones who wanted revenge on the Patriots. So Roger Goodell did the thing that they wanted. So there's a large group of owners, according to one storyline, that are very happy with him, and he's not in peril with them. I think he's in peril with the public in terms of his job security, but not necessarily with the owners.
But at some point, I think that has to hurt him. You know, you can't have the public. Yes, you have this billion-dollar product, multi-billion-dollar product, and the people who own that product, who are essentially the owners, are perfectly happy with the job you're doing, but you're actually starting to hurt the NFL and the reputation of the NFL.
You're
and
right.
That's
the reputation.
You're right.
But
if it comes across in attendance or in TV viewership, absolutely.
But they're still making scads of money. I mean, this is
$15 billion.
Yeah, this is the point that Bill Littlefield made on our show this week, that you can sort of be critical of Roger Goodell, but the reason why NFL team owners sort of like him is because he's still getting the cash to roll in.
But that's why, to some degree, this is nothing more than a distraction. The owners are happy because they're getting, you know, fatter and richer. And, you know, Patriots fans are thrilled because their team is still winning and not really being penalized. So it kind of has this sense that everybody wins, but in a funny way, everyone kind of loses at the same time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I mean, one of my big questions about this, if this is all true, if the Patriots really engage in this pattern of treating and trickery for years, and Renee, as you suggested, it looks like they have, is it just the Patriots, or is this just behavior that's been tolerated by the NFL, by the NFL in general across the league? What do you think?
I think there's all kinds of shifty gamesmanship that goes on in all major sports. You know, are the Patriots worse than others? Maybe. You know, but do I think that other teams pull all sorts of weird things, whether it's things with the amount of air in the balls or things with headsets for opposing teams and locker rooms? You know, there have been stories for years what the Boston Celtics used to do to opposing teams and all the issues that were going on in the locker rooms there. You know, I think that's part of the game, but I also think there's a point where it gets to be too much. You know, the same way that certain things were tolerated in baseball, but then when you finally had this idea that people were just loading up on steroids, then at some point you have to step in and say this isn't acceptable anymore.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's no question that people are out there trying to steal signals, that kind of thing. The same kind of thing that the Patriots are doing. But the Patriots have raised it to sort of a fine art. And it's the degree that they go to that really sets them apart. And also the fact that they keep getting caught. Mm. And that's a difficult situation to be in.
And keep not getting punished.
So I have one more question, then we've got to move on to the other news this week. But I'm just wondering, because one of the problems I've had with this story, and here we are leading the show with it, is I mean, there's so much other important stuff going on in the world, and we're spending an awful lot of time talking about it. On the other hand, the NFL represents some really serious issues that are rarely dealt with, like too many players suffering from brain damage, like too many players associated with domestic violence, and so on and so forth. So my question is does all this scrutiny, and maybe what's sort of come out over the last week or two about the NFL, do you think it might raise some kind of important scrutiny on the NFL and put it under some kind of pressure to deal with these bigger issues?
No.
What do you think? You don't think so? All right. Too bad.
I'll say ditto to that.
Ditto. All right. Well, on that, we'll move on. Let's talk about President Obama, who was in town on Monday for Boston's annual Labor Day breakfast. He announced an executive order requiring federal contractors to offer employees up to 7 paid sick days a year. The order will affect about 300,000 people. The president also used the occasion to give credit to Massachusetts for being ahead of the curve on this issue.
Here in Massachusetts, you're already ahead of the game. Last fall, folks easily approved paid sick leave throughout the Commonwealth. In May, Mayor Walsh signed an ordinance allowing for up to 6 weeks of paid parental leave for city employees. Y'all should be proud of what you're doing for working families in this state.
So, Renee, what's the significance of President Obama coming to Massachusetts to make the speech on Labor Day?
I think what was really important about his appearance, it sort of feeds into the narrative of the new Obama, the kind of the brand new Obama, the sort of, you know, to use an old hip-hop lyric, the do-what-you-like Obama. You know, he's not running for re-election, so he can kind of say anything. And I think that it's gotten to a point where he and a lot of Democrats are tired of people sort of demonizing workers, you know, and going after unions. So, you know, having Obama there, you know, in his blue shirt, his work shirt, mm-hmm. you know, talking about, you know, what Labor Day represents, how Labor Day came to be, you know, how you still have to take care of workers, how it's really important in a time when everyone thinks it's fine to kind of dump on workers and make it seem like they're all slags. I think it's really important for what he did on Monday.
Really interesting. Well, on that note, let's hear another cut from the president, because he, as you suggested, he used this appearance to talk about the important role that unions have played. Here's what he said.
They're the ones who gave us the 40-hour work week. They're the ones who gave us overtime and the minimum wage and all kinds of things that folks now take for granted. It was those fights that gave us health insurance and Social Security and Medicare and retirement plans. All those gains are union made. They're stamped with the union label. They're what we celebrate today.
So every now and then, as we know, President Obama has the ability to deliver a pretty good speech. My guess is not a lot of people were paying attention on that particular holiday. I was in here working, though, and followed along. John, it was a pretty strong speech, but I'd love your sort of response to his appearance in Boston.
One of the interesting things is in that clip, it was all past tense. And I think one of the problems with unions right now is where they stand in the present. They stand much weakened from where they were before.
Yeah.
And they also don't have the kinds of protections that that they might have otherwise had. When Barack Obama had a Democratic Congress, you know, that would have been a nice time to do this rule about federal contractors and paid sick leave. Now it's an executive order, and that's great, and it's better than nothing. But the truth of the matter is that the next president can come in and cancel out that executive order. So I think when you look at labor unions, they are sort of limping along at this point, and they're having difficulty. And I don't think that we'll talk about the Pacheco Law in a minute. I don't think that that they're getting the support from the Democratic Party and Democratic officials that they should be getting, or that they hope to get, or that they might be expected to get, given the support they've given to Democratic candidates. So I think it's a sort of a high wire act right now, and I think the unions are not getting stronger; they're getting weaker, and I think that's problematic.
Well, it's symbolic, and I think symbols are important, especially at a time when you have presidential candidates openly bashing unions. When you have Scott Walker and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who's pretty much built his reputation on again demonizing teachers and other union workers. I think it's important when the president of the United States gets up there and talks about all the things that unions have achieved, past tense perhaps, but that are still really valuable in our society today.
It was an interesting moment, too, because Elizabeth Warren was there as well. And let's not forget that they were sort of at odds over free trade in a big way. And it sort of seemed like there was maybe a fence mended there. I mean, did the president leave Boston with a pretty convincing case that he's a good friend of organized labor?
I think it was a good sort of PR appearance on his part. And I think that from that standpoint, it was positive for him. But again, the Pacific trade deal is something that is not favorable to unions. And, that is something that's going to potentially hurt unions. So there's a lot of things on the ground that are happening that that are putting unions at a disadvantage. And I think that it's an uphill battle. There's no question. But I think that the concrete things that the unions could be using are not really materializing at this point.
All right. Well, let's move on to a related story about organized labor, privatization, and the T. On Labor Day, President Obama was greeted by a bunch of people, including MBTA workers rallying against a proposal to privatize some bus routes, about 32 of them. A lot of opposition to that. Here's Massachusetts AFL-CIO President Stephen Tolman.
We've seen this scheme 30 years ago, 20 years ago. They always want to try to privatize services, and when we do that, we lose the continuity of public service. It seems sometimes profits over people take place.
All right. Now, Governor Baker successfully pushed for a suspension of a law that would allow the T to outsource some services. So this doesn't come as a huge surprise. T officials promised the union that no bus drivers would be laid off. But the president of the Boston Carmen's Union calls it a betrayal. Renee, is it, or does it make sense to privatize some routes? What's your view on this?
After the terrible, terrible winter of 2015, when the MBTA essentially became, the gang that couldn't commute straight,
right,
something needed to be done. And, we're not that far away from our next winter. So there was definitely a feeling that a move has to be made. No one's looking at privatization as this great panacea and it's going to solve all the problems. But I think there's a sense that there has to be some kind of movement to get a kind of financial structure back to the T and back to the MBTA so that it can actually operate and so it isn't completely shut down when we have bad weather. It's New England. We're going to have bad weather. We're going to have other problems. But, I understand where the unions are coming from on this, but the bottom line is the commuters need to be able to know that they can get from point A to point B. And that didn't happen last year. So I think it's an idea that maybe people are willing to look into. Mm.
John, what do you think?
This is really small beer. I mean, you're looking at some bus routes that are late at night. You're looking at
32 out of 750
something like that. Looking at something that's really peripheral to the serious problems that the MBTA has. It came out this week that the MBTA is paying some salaries out of their capital budget. Who does that? Nobody does that. And so they have so many problems that this is a problem for sure. And unions will say, you know, no employees are going to be laid off, but they might not be replaced when they're retired. You know, that's one of the issues with privatization. But when you look at it, this is really a small part. It's become a high-profile part, but it's a small part of what they have to address. They have so many bigger problems than this. I think that it would be too bad if they got hung up on this and didn't address the bigger overall issues.
Which is always the threat. It always seems like that can possibly happen because there's already enough noise about it that the fear is that they're not going to really get to the things they should be dealing with.
Well, let's stick with the T and specifically sort of how to tackle this bigger problem, how to fund it. We learned this week that Cambridge is considering levying a fee on real estate developers in Kendall Square to help pay for public transit improvement. It's not unprecedented. The New Balance shoe company has contributed something like $20 million for a new commuter rail station to serve its headquarters in Brighton. Federal Realty Investment Trust helped pay for the new Orange Line stop in Assembly Row in that development. But Renee, is this part of the future of the T?
I think it is. You know, I think that, you know, there's an argument to be made that if you are developing real estate in certain neighborhoods, that part of what makes that neighborhood attractive is mass transit. Mm-hmm. People need it in a city like Boston. Not everyone has a car, and it's a city that you can get around with a mass transit system. So I don't think it's unreasonable. It becomes another way that real estate developers can sell this and say, look, we have this great thing, and it's two blocks from a T stop. I think it's a fine idea.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, this transportation enhancement fund has worked successfully in other cities, San Francisco, Washington D.C., St. Louis, Kansas City, which may argue that it won't work here. But the other issue is that
spoken like a true Bostonian,
Cambridge is really going to the well on numerous occasions here. They already have a $10 per square foot fee for community outreach, that kind of thing, for developers to pay. Developers are looking for the opposite of this. Developers are looking for tax breaks. You know, that's what they're shopping around for. So I think this may be a hard sell. Kendall Square is one of the places where people really are salivating to develop, mm-hmm. and I think that's great. And you may have some leverage there, but I'm not sure that this is a big overall panacea for the MBTA. It might contribute a little bit, but I think it's going to be a tough sell.
Yeah, I think a community like Cambridge, you know, has more leverage to do that. That's not going to be the case in every neighborhood in Boston, but it's something that Cambridge can do, and I think Cambridge should do.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about the latest report to assess the big challenges at the Department of Children and Families, and they really are big challenges. This one comes from the Office of the Child Advocate. It was commissioned by the legislature, and it paints a picture of widespread dysfunction at an agency that has struggled with a series of tragedies involving children who have died or have been abused while under DCF watch. Among the problems, a lack of personnel, soaring caseloads, no agenda to improve DCF, insufficient accountability, reactionary decision-making, and terrible morale. Now, many of these problems were highlighted in a report released last week that examined the case of the 7-year-old child from Hardwick who fell into a coma after his father allegedly beat him and starved him. Here's how Governor Baker reacted to that.
110 visits. So many eyes on the child. Nobody putting the whole picture together. It certainly implies systemic failures.
So, John, big challenges at DCF, to say the least. Everyone seems to acknowledge them. What has to happen?
Well, I think you've got a couple of areas they have to look at. They have to look at the caseload that the caseworkers have. I mean, they have too many clients to deal with. And you also have to look at management has too many caseworkers to supervise. They've had a pretty large exodus from the management ranks at DCF because of Governor Baker's buyout, his retirement buyout. And so they have a real dearth of management supervisors to oversee caseworkers. Somewhere along the line, someone's got to put it together. I think that should happen at the management level, but I'm not sure that they're equipped to do that. And I think that creates a difficult situation for them. The other thing with DCF is they are so gun-shy now over news media reports that in many ways it feels like, and this came out in a Child Advocate report, it feels like they're playing not to lose as opposed to playing to win, playing to try to avoid negative media attention. And that puts them in a situation where they're never going to really make a serious progress dealing with the problems that they have.
Such a huge challenge. Renee, what's your analysis?
You know, it's like the old expression, you know, you have one job. to protect vulnerable children. And, you know, when mistakes are made or responsibilities are neglected, children are harmed and children die, often in really horrific ways. And I almost feel like there's not a bigger outcry about this because people almost take this as the price of doing business with DCF. You know, we're having all these conversations now because of what happened to this poor kid in Hardwick, but these conversations were being had a year ago when Jeremiah Oliver, they finally realized after a year that he was missing and just how many mandatory visits weren't made to that house. So that was last spring. Now we're in almost fall of 2015, and, you know, we're having audits and there's more reports coming out and talking about how DCF isn't getting the job done. Well, there has to be something more to that. So maybe if something had changed a year ago, maybe what happened in Hardwick would not have occurred. Mm. Maybe what happened in, I believe it was Auburn, when you had one infant who died, another one who's still listed in dire condition, maybe that wouldn't have happened. So at some point, they have to get past reports and they have to actually take some action and do something to protect these kids, because you can't have kids who just get lost in the system or just get ignored by the agencies whose job it is to protect them.
All right. Well, certainly there is a tension on this issue. Let's hope that that attention, as you suggest, Renee, leads to something beyond reports. So we can move on now. We should move on now to our hubbubs, those stories that caught the attention of our panelists but that maybe fell below the fold. And John, let me come to you first for your hubbub.
My hubbub this week is the production of Radium Girls over at the Charlestown Working Theater. It's a play by D.W. Gregory about young women in the 1920s who worked in a factory that produced luminous watch dials, and they were the ones who painted the numbers on the dials. The problem was the paint was radium-based, and they would sharpen their brushes by licking them, so they would bring them to a point. And what happened was they got radium poisoning, essentially, and they started disintegrating from the inside out. It's a terrific all-female cast. They move from role to role, from gender to gender, really smartly and adroitly. The staging is really inventive. It's a really terrific production that, unfortunately, hasn't been reviewed in either of the two local dailies. So it's there through September 19th. It's a terrific production. I recommend it highly. Charlestown Working Theater,
Radium Girls. Renee, your hubbub.
All week we've been hearing about Hillary Clinton's poll numbers dropping. And what really told me Hillary was in trouble was the fact that she was on Ellen DeGeneres' show this week doing the whip and the nay-nay. Now, when you have politicians who feel the need to dance on TV, kind of like, say, a restaurant with the name Tiki in its title, it will never end well. And there was poor Hillary in her electric blue suit trying to learn this very popular dance. I don't even know what to make of that. You know, if you're solid in the polls, you don't see Bernie Sanders doing the nay nay now, do you? I'm not saying he can't do it, but you don't see him trying.
He does have a record album out though from back in the 80s.
That's true.
With a remix, you never know.
You
know, one day with Kendrick Lamar, he could have a hit.
You never know.
I mean, that was my takeaway of the week. It's like the first time I saw that clip, I thought, she's in trouble, y'all. She's on Ellen, and she's trying to dance. Never a good sign. Never good.
Well, here's my hubbub. It's good news for animal lovers this week, as federal wildlife officials announced today that they're taking the New England cottontail off the potential endangered species list. Efforts to protect and restore the rabbit's habitat apparently have paid off. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that there are now 10,500 cottontails living east of the Hudson River. Some conservationists are concerned that taking the bunnies off the list for protection is too soon. But for now, it looks like Peter Cottontail is back in action. So
if we could just get them booked on Ellen, it would be a big coup.
Teach them the nay-nay.
Let them whip, let them nay-nay.
Renee Graham, she's an op-ed contributor to the Boston Globe. Renee, it was great having you, and come back and do this again with us if you would.
Thanks, Anthony.
Yes, have a great weekend. And John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University, senior analyst for WBUR. John Carroll, have a great weekend.
You too.